All right, we have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. We will take one break in between the two cases because we do have a panel change in between. The first case is in the interest of K&M. If the clerk will please announce the parties and their counsel. Mr. Parker.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Scott Parker, counsel for the appellant, Misty Meyer Tate, as announced by the clerk. In the case that I'm presenting before you today, it involves four brief issues for which I seek your wisdom and judgment on today. The first of those, and I think were you guys provided with a copy of my oral argument outline?
Yes,
okay,
we do
great.
Have that.
Great. The first issue that needs to be addressed is whether what expression of words are necessary for a court to render a present intent to render. I'm sorry. What expression of words are necessary for a court to express their present intent to render a judgment when dictated into the record? The second thing is whether a court can enforce a settlement agreement as an agreed judgment with additional terms added and lacking consent. And the third is whether a settlement agreement should be enforced as an agreed judgment or must be the subject of a contract action requiring additional pleadings and proof. And the fourth, whether parties' agreement or contract to determine and bind the future best interest of the child is void as against public policy.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
It looks like these four issues aren't the same as the issues in your brief.
The issues in my brief, I basically, they're intertwined. I just broke them out into different highlighted areas as to the fact that in the brief, and I can break them out for you.
That's fine. Just if when you do your argument, you could reference where in the brief
sure.
those arguments are, that would be great.
Okay, no problem. Basically, I'm going to be addressing issues 3 and 4, really what I'm going to be arguing, I mean, that where they're intertwined as to the, you know, signing an order without proper proof and one that actually when consent was withdrawn. That's for the first two issues. And then the third and fourth issue is the signing of a non-conforming judgment. Oh, and I apologize. I did give a letter brief. Hopefully you have a copy of the letter brief that was admitted. The letter brief addresses the final issues, I think, in it. It's a two-page brief.
Okay.
Do you have a copy of that? Or
uh-huh.
Okay, great. So that's where I was getting confused, because, yes, in the original brief, it didn't have all the issues that I'm addressing, but the letter brief does.
Okay. Thank you.
Addressing words used by the court to render judgment, basically in this case, no judgment was rendered by the trial court. On March 31st, 2008, the trial court rendered the following decision in the court and stated the words, the court will approve the agreements as they have been stated for the record, and I will make it the written order of the court when it is submitted. The wording used by the court when dictated on the record indicated the intent to render a judgment at a future time and not that day. And as you are aware, in Tining versus Willingham, this court stated the following, that had the trial court rendered judgment at the time the settlement was dictated into the record, we would have simply remanded this case for entry of the judgment in accordance with that agreement. However, at the close of the settlement hearing, the trial court stated on the record I'm not going to state or read the whole part, but basically they stated that I've heard the agreement of the parties, and I will approve that agreement and adopt that as my order, settling all these matters in this estate. And then it later said, and that will be my order then. And what they meant by that will be my order then is when a order is signed by the parties and submitted for their signature, whereas in our case, it's stating that they will make a written order of the court when it is submitted as well. And so it is apparent from these statements that the trial court contemplated rendition of the judgment at some time in the future. And rendition of a judgment is a present act that decides the issues upon which the ruling is made. So what it's said in Intercoastal Warehouse, that absent an expression of words of action indicating the present intent to render judgment, rendition doesn't occur that day on the record. And so our arguments are by applying the principles above, and especially in Tining and other cases that I mentioned in my brief, the words used by the judge at that on that day intended to render a judgment at a future date. And in fact, that is exactly what the trial court did on July 16, 2008. However, they entered a judgment for appellant by signing an order later after the consent was withdrawn by my client and notified the court by filing withdrawal of consent at that time. So the reason I'm addressing this issue first is because if you're in agreement with me as to the fact that the words that were used are similar and are stating a future intent, then therefore the day that the court heard the oral rendition, which was a slight, it didn't include all the material facts and so forth, that day, by saying they would do something in the future and that they will enter the order, is an intent to do so in the future, and therefore on that date it was not rendered. And the importance of that is...
Yes, ma'am. That might be true if the case involves some type of agreed judgment or something, but wasn't it I think a Rule 11 agreement becomes binding when it's announced in open court and read into the record.
And that's the issue I'm going to address additionally as to the fact that if they find that a settlement agreement was reached, then the proper vehicle would be to file a motion for enforcement of a contract and or an agreement, which in this case, a motion to enter final order was only filed, and the opposing side's arguing that their motion to enter final order was interpreted by the court and the same as a motion for breach of contract and or for enforcement of a settlement agreement or contract, which indeed it states in other cases that you have to actually have due process in order to do that, which requires proper pleadings, which is the proper vehicle in which to do so by filing a motion to enforce a settlement agreement and or contract. You also have to have proper proof of the existence of a contract. You also have to have proper notice, and you have to have a proper hearing in order to go forward on that, which in this case, we had none. We had no due process.
Well, how can you have no due process when it was announced in open court before the judge with all parties and their lawyers present?
You can't have due process as to an enforcement of a contract action. I'm not saying that we did not have that there wasn't an oral settlement agreement on the record. That actually, what I'm saying is, and maybe I'm confusing you guys or something, but as for for a Rule 11 agreement to be valid and for a final judgment to be entered on the day the oral rendition was rendered on the court, that's how I should have probably said it, I apologize. They needed to use the proper terminology or the proper words of present intent, not future intent.
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am.
We have opinion after opinion after opinion coming out of this court saying we will affirm. And we mean, we're not writing another opinion. This is it. This is the only opinion you're getting. And in this opinion, we are affirming. And that's what we're going to do.
Yes, ma'am.
Right now.
Right.
I mean, that's just the way judges talk.
I understand that. And I'm going on the case law that this court rendered with the words that were used in that trial court as well, that they will render a final order upon someone submitting an order to them for them to sign. And that's what they did here.
So you think that announcing it in open court has no force, no effect? It was just
no, ma'am.
Nothing.
I'm not saying that, no, ma'am. I'm saying it can have effect and a force as a settlement agreement, but in order for a settlement agreement to be enforceable or to be enforced, it has to they have to have a hearing on or proper pleadings to request that a settlement agreement be enforced. So I'm not saying that it nullifies the agreement.
Okay, I understand the agreement, and that'll be the order of the court. That doesn't mean that's the order of the court?
That's why I'm seeking your wisdom. I'm saying that
okay.
Based on the case law that you have rendered previously and based on other cases in Texas, it says that I will, by them stating I will render an order, and I will approve and enter that order upon receipt, and I will sign the order, meaning that that's when it becomes final.
So the question is, what effect does oral pronouncement of an order have?
No, ma'am. The question is, what words are necessary for the court to say, okay, what you've rendered before me, or what to make a final judgment that day, a judgment, not a settlement agreement. So there's a difference between it, an agreement and a judgment. I mean, and basically, let me see, I have that further here. That they're basically in Padilla versus LaFranks, that the appellees confuse they confuse the requirement for an agreed judgment with those of an enforceable settlement agreement. And I think that's what we're talking about here today, is that what was done that day, we're trying to find out what words are necessary for a final judgment versus a settlement agreement, enforceable settlement agreement, are necessary for the court to have a final judgment or an agreed judgment that day everything's final. And it showed in a lot of case law basically that said that today we find that this judgment is final, and that's based on material terms being included in it and covering all or most of all the important issues that are necessary for a final order. And so that's my argument, is that there's a difference between the requirements for an agreed judgment and enforceable settlement judgment. And later I'm going to address some more of that, if I may continue. Basically, the second issue that we must address, because first and foremost, like I said, we address whether or not what words are necessary to make a final judgment that day versus whether that Rule 11 agreement would be interpreted as a settlement agreement. And so the trial court, we argue the trial court abused its discretion when it decided to enforce a settlement agreement by signing the agreed final order after consent had been withdrawn and additional terms, material terms, not previously agreed on, were added to the order. And in the Texas Supreme Court under Burnham versus Heaton has in other cases has consistently held that in order for a consent judge to be valid, consent must exist at the time the judgment is rendered. So where we're going or coming from is that, okay, the Rule 11 agreement that was orally argued would most likely be a settlement agreement that can be enforceable through the proper, avenue, meaning the proper pleadings, proof, hearing, and notice for the hearing. But the court additionally, like I said, in this case, made it clear that there's a difference between an agreed judgment and an enforceable settlement agreement. Here, there was no Rule 11 agreement filed setting out the settlement terms prior to appellant's consent being withdrawn and the judgment being signed by the trial court. And that goes to Padilla. I think Padilla is our main issue, or a case that both sides are really quoting. That in Padilla, the Supreme Court held that a series of letters between the parties contained all material terms and was sufficient to constitute an agreement in writing satisfying the Rule 11 agreement because they had all the terms. In our case, we actually deferred issues that we would address at a later date on the record. We said, okay, well, the issue regarding flight of the child or issue regarding pickup drop-off, there were certain issues that we said on the record, well, we'll deal with that later. And we said those words specifically. It's well established that a court cannot render valid judgment absent consent at the time it was rendered under Padilla. And if an agreed judgment is rendered when consent is lacking, the proper course is to reverse the judgment and remand the case to the trial court without prejudice to the rights of the parties to seek to enforce or to avoid enforcement of a settlement agreement. And that's where I'm saying that the proper avenue, proper notice, proper pleadings and hearing were required in this situation based on the enforcement of a settlement agreement, which was most likely what was entered on the day it was orally dictated into the record.
I have another question.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Does it have to be either or? I mean, does it have to be either a Rule 11 settlement agreement or a consent judgment? Can't you have a Rule 11 agreement as to certain terms of a judgment and leave?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. So isn't that what we have here?
No, ma'am, because that's why I was arguing that they added material terms and deleted material terms that were actually orally rendered, that we actually agreed to on the record. So that would be the case in other circumstances. In our case, and the reason it's or unique is because in our case, there was terms that the court actually, because the grandmother, a third party, submitted an order to the court on their motion to enter order, final order, to sign, and they signed an order that actually added terms that were not agreed to, deleted terms that were agreed to on the record. And it says...
What terms were deleted?
The terms of visitation in the temporary orders agreement and in the parties before the grandmother got involved, the father and the mother and the attorneys, myself and the other counsel for the other appellee, had signed a decree which also rendered a decision as to the visitation. The visitation was, instead of the first, third, and fifth, it was the second, fourth weekends, because my client is remarried and her husband has four children, and they wanted to raise them together, and they were used to being together, and they had done that for many, many years before, and the grandmother submitted an order, and that was our intent all along, even the other side's intent, and they submitted an order that did the opposite of that, that now the kids are not together. They can't, the birthday parties, they're not being raised together because of this, and this is impacting the child a lot.
And that was part of the agreement that was announced in open court?
No, ma'am. There was nothing specific. That's what I'm saying. The material terms of the agreement were just implied and between the father and the mother. And then that goes to the fact that, you know, a third party is involved that comes in and gives the court an order that is basically standard, and the parties that implied on the record but didn't state on the record material terms, which are the visitation that had been going on all along and was their intent and thought it was going to be that way but didn't do so. Okay.
All right, Mr. Parker, your time is up.
Okay.
Mr. Rivera.
Madam Justices, may it please the court. My name is Victor Rivera, and I represent Appellee Deborah Meyer, who is the grandmother intervener in this case. I will begin my argument by addressing the issue of rendition that appellant has raised this morning, which appellant claims that is part of his issue in his brief. The rendition question, I would ask this court to look at Padilla versus LaFrance, found at 907 Southwest 2D 454. That is a Supreme Court case in 1995, and I would refer to page 461 of that case, which states that a Rule 11 does not state when a Rule 11 must be filed. A Rule 11 is created the day that the agreement is made in open court. All parties were present on March 31st, 2008, in the trial court to actually have a standing hearing to determine whether or not grandmother should be allowed to intervene in this case. Prior to that hearing, at no point in time did appellant file any type of motion to strike, which is required by Texas Rules of Civil Procedure 60. When someone intervenes, the person that does not want that person to intervene must do a motion to strike. There was no pleas in intervention, etc. However, a standing hearing was set for the same morning that the final hearing was set. Unfortunately, neither occurred because all parties involved decided to create an agreement outside of the court's presence. They approached the court, advised the court that they reached an agreement. The Honorable Judge Gabriel announced that to that effect, and that's in the supplemental record for March 31st. She asked if everyone was in agreement. All parties and all attorneys for those parties said they were. And at that point in time, all parties were put on the stand and questioned in regards to what the agreement would entail. Those agreements were then created, the Rule 11 agreement, which should have been created by the appellant, but he failed to put it on paper. However, Padilla versus LaFrance states that that's not necessary. It doesn't have to necessarily be on paper or rushed to the courthouse to get a signature on that, because Rule 11 states that as long as the pleading is made in open court with all parties involved, identified, it suffices the Rule 11 requirements. Padilla versus LaFrance also points out that it would be against Texas jurisprudence to physically require someone to immediately rush to the courthouse to get a signature on a document. That is on page 461. The Texas Supreme Court also points out to Birdville versus Cox, which is a very long-standing case from 1875. The cite on that is 18 Texas 535, and I'm referring to page 537, where it states, the purpose of filing requirement is to put the agreement before the court so that the court can judge its import and proceed to act upon it with safety. So simply by having had the appellant created the document, which he advised the trial court he would create, all the trial court would have done was look at that document and make sure it matched what was said in open court. Nothing would have been changed. They would have just said, this matches, nothing has been altered, and the judge would have signed it. But Padilla versus LaFrance specifically states, just because nothing was signed, the Rule 11 agreement still stands. When appellant decided not to create the document and attempted to withdraw his consent, thus the intervener, grandmother, then had no choice but to come in front of the trial court and ask the trial court to make it a judgment of the court because she was left with no remedies. In addressing the actual issue that's listed in the brief, the appellant claims that his client was stripped of due process, that the 14th Amendment was violated, and that because of Troxell, the grandmother's intervention in this case was unconstitutional, etc. However, as you see in our brief, it states that Troxell doesn't even play a role in this because the court itself, the trial court, never had to make the decision in regards to who was joint managing conservator, who was going to be primary, what the visitation would entail. That was done by the parties in their Rule 11 agreement.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't this raise some policy concerns? I mean, can we have an agreement for non-parental custody absent a trial court finding of best interest, which is what has happened here?
As far as I'm aware, Your Honor, no. But in this case, because the parties went to the stand, they actually testified that it was in the best interest of the child.
Okay, so that's in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. All parties were questioned. The appellant was then cross-examined as well. All the parties involved knew that by going forward without actually having a standing hearing, actually having the court determine who's going to be primary, who's not, is grandmother going to have any type of visitation, that they've taken it upon themselves and they determined in their best interest this was best for the child. What we're speaking of today is grandmother received 4 days of visitation in the summer. 2 days taken from Mr. Colleen, and I apologize if I say the name incorrectly, his first name's Anthony, and 2 days from the appellant, thus for a 4-day visit in the summer. And that was created due to the fact that grandmother already had a bond with the child. She helped raise the child and the appellants live with grandmother on 2 occasions. In addition, she assisted with bills along the way, financial and medical. And so these were things that were put in her petition for intervention, which she was ready to argue that day. However, she was circumvented by all the parties saying, we can come up to an agreement. She agreed. She even testified on the stand that she was aware she had an opportunity to be heard by the trial court and that the trial court could have possibly given her no visitation with the child because she's grandmother, or could have given her more based upon her bond with the child. And my client was in agreement that they settled it outside the presence of the court, and that was in the best interest of the child. And so because of that, this case would be different from just plainly saying this person has standing, such as in Troxell, where Troxell was so broad, it left anyone possibly to come forward and say, I have standing in this case, I want to have visitation with this child. And that's the difference that we have today, Your Honor. In regards to the actual, again, grounds for the intervention, Texas Rules of Civil Procedure 60 is what allows my client to intervene. In addition, Texas Family Code 102.004B, my client was simply intervening on a case that was already pending in front of the court, so she did not have to, per Texas Family Code, have standing to bring the intervention. It was the burden of the appellant or possibly additional appellee to strike the intervention and to request a hearing, which never took place. We would also ask this court to look at the appellant's brief stating that standing was granted by the trial court in chambers. That is incorrect. The record is silent as to any standing hearing whatsoever. In Stubbs v. Stubbs, a Texas Supreme Court case found at 685 Southwest 2D, 643, it specifically states that in all SAPSR hearings, oral testimony must be recorded, which would have required the trial court to have any type of standing hearing in the courtroom in the presence of a court reporter, not inside the chambers, as appellant states took place. Had that taken place, it would have been improper for the Honorable Judge Gabriel to allow that to happen. And at no point in time does the Honorable Judge Gabriel state that that took place. The record is silent as to that matter. We would then also like to address the second issue in the appellant's brief, which is the appellant's claim that the grandmother has been basically granted physical possession by the trial court. Again, we would ask this court to look at the documents provided to note that the trial court had nothing to do other than listening to the agreement of the parties in the court. The trial court did not make any rules, did not make any exceptions, basically allowed the parties to be questioned and interviewed by their own attorneys, cross-examined, and stated that that would be the ruling of the court because that's what they agreed to. We're simply here today because the grandmother asked the court to enforce that Rule 11 by creating the SAPSR order that appellant decided he would not create. Appellant did bring what was supposedly a signed order between the appellant and appellee Kalen prior to the intervention of the mother. However, the trial court noted that was never submitted to the record. Had it been submitted to the record, the intervention wouldn't be here for this intervention. We wouldn't have this issue because they would have had an order signed and the SAPSR would have been completed already. However, nothing was submitted to the court. So having a document that purports to have a signature of another attorney, it would not be sufficient to say we have an agreement, a judgment, because nothing was presented to the court until after the fact, after the motion for enforcement, after I believe it was raised at the motion for new trial.
What is your client's position in regard to the attempt to withdraw consent?
Your Honor, in regards to the attempt to withdraw consent, my client states that the appellant should not be allowed to do that because she has created a binding contract as per Rule 11. The appellant's attempt to withdraw the consent was possibly a misreading of Padilla, attempting to state that there is a difference between a consent judgment and an agreed judgment. However, a consent was not present in regards to the hearing date, March 31st, 2008. It was an agreed judgment. The appellant came forward, took the stand, all parties, to include both appellees, took the stand and created this document, making it a binding contract. And she cannot then wait 2 months and decide, I've read Troxell, now I want to withdraw my consent. Troxell says otherwise. Troxell does not address Rule 11 agreements. It talks about the broadness of the other state's ability for allowing anyone to intervene in a child's life. It was too broad. This state, Texas, has rules in place to prevent that from happening. And one of those, and those are found in the Texas Family Code, and as of today, they still remain constitutional. So we would ask this court to rule that attempting to withdraw her consent after the fact, after she had already put it on the record and testified that she was in agreement, would be invalid.
What do you say to, or how do you respond to their statement of a lack of pleadings on a motion to enforce the Rule 11 agreement?
Your Honor, I apologize. Could you rephrase it?
Opposing counsel says there were no pleadings on enforcement of the Rule 11 agreement.
No, Your Honor. The appellant was given an opportunity to come forward, and the appellant raised issues such as there were terms added, material terms added, things that were not addressed. We brought it to the attention of the court and in our brief that certain things have been misconstrued by the appellant. The joint managing conservator was agreed to on March 31st, 2008. Appellant was given primary on March 31st, 2008. Those are things that we incorporated into the motion for enforcement. The Honorable Judge Gabriel advised the appellant that if there were errors, if they didn't think the actual SAPSR order that was created by myself matched the Rule 11 agreement, that there was remedies that he could take, and she would make sure that it matched what she heard the day of the hearing on March 31st. However, those were not taken, such as a judgment non pro tunc, asking the court to look at this and point out if something has been added inadvertently, intentionally, etc. However, appellant did not take those steps. Appellant was adamant that her consent was removed and that should be sufficient and we should never even be here to begin with, that she was allowed to remove that consent. And so the trial court did hear what was presented to the court, and the term that appellant does raise about first, third, and fifth versus second, fourth, that was not raised on March 31st, and that may have been an issue that should have been addressed, but it was not ever addressed by the appellant. Simply standard was put into the SAPSR order. Your Honor, I would state that we would ask you to rule in favor of the appellant, to honor the trial court's judgment in regards to the Rule 11 being valid and that the SAPSR order that was created matched the Rule 11 of March 31st, 2008. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Rivera. Mr. Parker, rebuttal.
First and foremost, the question that you asked, if I may address, that you asked Mr. Rivera, Mr. Rivera just stated that they incorporated, you asked what his thoughts were as to our arguments that they didn't use the proper vehicle or the proper pleadings, proof, notice, and hearing as to the enforcement of an agreement. What Mr. Rivera just stated is they incorporated it in their motion for enforcement, the terms of the agreed order. I think there was never a motion for enforcement filed is what I think you were asking, or should there have been. Based on the case law, that it is necessary, and they continuously in their pleadings state that there was a contract created, and I'm not saying that there was an agreement created on the date of March 31st. I'm just saying that there was not a final order rendered by the terms that were used by the court as to making it final that day, and their intent was for future day. So as you were asking earlier, I think, Judge, is that, you know, what's that in there? I'm saying that there's nothing that happened that day. No, ma'am. I'm saying that there actually was something that happened as to maybe a settlement agreement or an agreement, but not a final judgment. Also, Mr. Rivera stated that the grandmother was involved in the child's life. The grandmother had not been involved in the child's life for 2 years. The grandmother stopped. Would not cooperate with the mother during the time after the order was rendered on the record or orally testified to. And Mr. Rivera also stated that the parties actually stated on the record that it was their understanding and belief that it was in the best interest. That was never addressed. The best interest was never addressed on the record as to what the child, after my client read or understood Padilla, which appellee grandmother argues are not valid reasons under Troxel for anything under, I mean, not Padilla, Troxel, I apologize, that we have no arguments as to Troxel. Well, basically, Troxel, it recognized the interests of a parent's care, custody, and control of the children is perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests. Also, Texas courts have long stated that the natural right exists between the parents and the children is a constitutional dimension, and that these parental interests are fundamental rights protected under due process of the 14th Amendment and under the U.S. Constitution. And that's where I go into the public policy issue. Is public policy in the state that the best interest of the child be the primary consideration for the court and conservatorship issues? And what we're arguing is that, okay, first, whether or not there was a final judgment rendered on the day, March 31st, we argue no. They didn't use the proper terminology or terms for finality on that day. Yet, an agreement was rendered on the record, but consent was withdrawn. And as the case law states, that if consent is withdrawn before a court signs an order or enters an order, that is supposed to follow the terms and conditions that were rendered on the the oral testimony, which Mr. Rivera also states that they intend, they would like the court to make it as it was intended, but not as to how they submitted it, which is what we're saying, that the material terms are totally off what the temporary orders were, what the intent of the parties were. Even though they weren't stated, it was just assumed by the parties and the attorneys that that's what would take place. Now, by them, you know, it violates the public policy as to the fact that the court has the ultimate power and control over what is in the best interest of the child. Parties, and especially a third party, should not be able to contract for the future best interest of the child. And that this is in my outline and in my brief, whereas it says the parents shouldn't even be able to contract for the future best interest of the child in case law. And that is under, I think it's under, well, it's in my brief, actually, the supplemental brief. What work in conclusion is our belief that this announcement in open court fell short of a final agreement for judgment, that the agreed order signed by the trial court lacked consent and left out and supplemented material terms, provisions, and details that made it invalid and unenforceable, and the agreement and or contract for future possession of the child involving a third party that is not a parent is not in the child's best interest and violates public policy. Mr. Rivera's order said that grandmother had superior right, gave her superior right to custody of this child. In there, it states that. It specifically states superior right. It doesn't, and also, my time's up.
But just for those 4 days, correct?
It doesn't say just for the 4 days. It says grandmother has superior right to the child. Now, there, you would assume that, yes, Your Honor. You would assume that that's what the intent of it was. But it's just, I mean, you know, it's up to you guys, but I feel that this is going to be a major decision because of the fact that if we allow a third party to come in and make this, you know, an arrangement as to the best interest of the child, it takes away from the court's right to do so, which is their ultimate right. So, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Thank you, Mr. Rivera. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted. We will take about a 5-minute recess for a panel change.
Thank you, Your Honor.